Important information regarding the use of artificial intelligence in this version of the podcast. The text and voices in this episode were generated using artificial intelligence based on the original episode in German. The content and voices may therefore differ from the original podcast.
Michael's Green World, Episode 16. Why self-sufficiency does not prevent power outages. How Primeo Energy ensures security of supply in the energy transition. Welcome to Michael's Green World. This podcast is also about how we can shape the energy transition together, ecologically, economically, and with technical realism. Today we take a look at a topic that is hardly visible in everyday life until it is suddenly missing: security of electricity supply. How can we ensure that electricity flows reliably not only today, but also tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, especially at a time when everything is being converted to electricity? Heating, vehicles, data centers, almost every lifeline is becoming electric. And without electricity, suddenly nothing works anymore. I myself live with my family and our neighbors on a converted farm near a nature reserve. A classic oil tank was never an option there. Instead, we have set up a decentralized energy system for two residential units. It consists of a 16 kilowatt air water heat pump as the main heat source. A 20 kilowatt logwood heating system serves as a backup in case of extreme cold or power outages. Two tiled stoves provide additional support and comfort. A 30 kilowatt peak photovoltaic system is located on the roofs, and we also have almost 60 kilowatt hours of battery storage suitable for off-grid operation with an E3DC system. Together with our neighbors who live in the second part of the house, the former farmyard was converted into a semi-detached house over 30 years ago. We operate a so-called ZEV, i.e. a joint venture for our own consumption. This means that we generate solar power on the roof of the property, use it locally, and settle among ourselves who has consumed how much. Because our daily rhythms are different, we can significantly increase our own consumption and at the same time reduce the load on the public grid. All of this gives us a great feeling of independence, but only locally and for a limited time. If our house still has power during a blackout, for example for 3 hours, that's helpful for us, but it doesn't solve the problem for the city or region. It would be a dangerous mistake to believe that such isolated solutions are sufficient on their own. Security of supply is a systemic issue, and that is exactly what this episode is about. Today I am at Primeo Energy, and I am joined by Cedric Crisman, the CEO of Primeo Energy. It is a company that is much more than just an electricity supplier. Cedric, it's great to have you here. Please introduce yourself briefly. Who is Primeo Energy? What do you do? And what is particularly important to you in your work?
Hello, Michael. It's great that you found your way here. We are here in Münchenstein. Münchenstein is where the company was founded, and Primeo Energy is an old lady. It is now 127 years old. Even back then, our fathers realized that they couldn't do it alone. That's why they founded a cooperative, and Primeo Energy is still a cooperative today. We have our roots here in Münchenstein, but we now also work at many other locations. What do we do? We operate electricity grids. That was how the company started out. Of course, we also supply electricity. Today, we also offer heating. We produce and supply heat, not only in the region, but throughout Switzerland and also in France. We are also active in electricity production. We do this in several countries through our stake in Alpiq, but also through Aventron, a company we founded in 2005. There, we are active in three technologies: hydropower, small hydropower, wind power, and solar power in 5 to 6 countries. We also have a subsidiary in Norway that is active in electricity production. And I think what's important is that Primeo sees itself as a comprehensive energy supplier. Yes, and security of supply is also key when it comes to energy supply. That's important to us, and yes, it only works if we work together. What we are seeing is that it's also about convergence between these technologies, for example, heat and electricity.
What do you mean by convergence? What do you mean by heat and electricity being used together?
We are facing a major challenge, especially here in Switzerland. We have to move away from gas and toward renewable heat. Some even say that the energy transition is also a heat transition. In Switzerland alone, we are talking about around 30 terawatt hours of gas. In France, around 450. And in Germany, almost 900 terawatt hours. These are enormous amounts of energy. We have to replace them with renewable solutions. For us, this means waste heat from industry, for example. We have to use it. Yes, but we are also trying to use wood. However, wood is a scarce resource. It is only enough to replace 5 to 15% of what we need. And then, of course, there is the option of using heat pumps with or without probes. I believe you have one, Michael.
Air.
An air solution. I have a water-water solution at home with geothermal probes.
That's even more efficient.
It has a better COP. So yes, the efficiency is better. And what I can do in addition is cool.
That's great.
Cool sensibly.
That's very useful in the middle of summer. Summer and winter, yes, December, January, February, my electricity bill is high, and that's exactly what you're talking about. And on the subject of wood, when I bought the wood-burning stove, there were some very wise people who said, yes, it's quite cheap at the moment, and everyone is talking about waste wood. But at some point, when lots of people have switched over, it will become a scarce commodity. That was 10 years ago. They were smart people and they were right. And I'm glad that today I only have wood as an emergency solution with 20 kilowatts of heating power, but normally the heat pump runs. Solar power for the heat pump makes sense, of course, especially in the transition period. In summer, you have too much electricity.
Exactly.
And you refer to this interaction as convergence, that this coexistence works sensibly. The question here is also, what happens now in the event of a blackout? We wanted to discuss the systemic issue, and we can do that particularly well with you because you have all the levers at your disposal. And that's why the question is, what is a blackout? How should we look at it? When everyone talks about a blackout, they actually mean that the power goes out, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the heat goes out. So first of all, what is the blackout we're talking about today? And what are we doing to prevent a situation like the one on the Iberian Peninsula a few months ago, where the power was practically completely out for several days?
Yes, when we talk about a blackout, we're talking about a long power outage across a region. Let's take a look back. Last year, on August 26th, 2024, we had no power for several hours. That's a power outage. A blackout lasts more than a few hours. It's worse.
Okay.
It's a large-scale power outage lasting a day or more, which is what actually happened on the Iberian Peninsula.
That wasn't expected.
I think it came as a surprise to many that something like that could even happen. And on top of that, when we all say that electricity is the energy source of the 21st century, it makes you worry twice as much. So are we converting the system too quickly? Are we taking risks that we haven't even identified? What happened there? And I think there was a contradiction a little bit.
Cedric, many people say we want more autonomy, and that's a good thing, because today Switzerland imports around 70% of its energy. That's mainly oil and gas with some nuclear energy. And that's exactly what we want to replace with renewable energy from Switzerland.
Exactly. The Swiss Energy Strategy 2050 clearly states that we want to move away from imports. Instead of buying 70%, we want to produce 70% ourselves and from renewable sources.
So the plan is to ramp up our own production and to do so sustainably and then gradually reduce our dependence on fossil fuels.
Exactly. And that requires investment, infrastructure, grid expansion, and a lot of patience. That's the idea of autonomy. Autonomy does not mean self-sufficiency. Electricity is a grid-bound energy source. That's the only way it can be transported. And that's where our neighbors become extremely important. Now in Spain, for those who are familiar with the Spanish grid topology, Spain is connected to France via power lines. So the entire Iberian Peninsula is connected to France. And there are a couple of cables. The largest cable is in the Pyrenees, underground, with a capacity of about 2,000 megawatts or 2 gigawatts. That's an important cable, but it's not enough. It accounts for 3% of the effective power that Spain and Portugal need. And the European Union has set a minimum quota of 15%, which would be necessary. So that means Spain's problem is not autonomy. Spain's problem is exactly the opposite, namely that they are far too poorly connected to the European system. And now they want to expand the connection, and there are plans to do so. An additional cable must be built by 2028, but that won't be enough. That would add about 2,000 megawatts of power. Then we would be at about 4,800. Much more needs to be built. The British know that too, by the way. They are building lots and lots of lines in all directions. To Norway, to Europe, to ensure security of supply. We in Switzerland have 41 connections to the European Union. We benefit from this, of course, yes. Not only can we optimize our power plants, but we also benefit from this exchange, of course. And that is fundamental. So autonomy, yes, but not self-sufficiency. And that's true for a country. It's true for a neighborhood. It's true for a house. Yes, there are solutions. You mentioned the isolated solution you implemented at your place. That works for a few hours, but systemically, if you have electricity but the bank doesn't because the power is out or the cell phone tower isn't working, you may have electricity at home, but you can't make phone calls and you can't go to the bank to withdraw money. So you can see that when electricity becomes essential for everyday life, you have to stay connected. A yes to emergency solutions, in my opinion, that's not a contradiction. But the idea that you have to think systematically is very important, and that you have to stay connected is, I believe, extremely important. And that's why I always say quite simply, autonomy, yes, self-sufficiency, no. Besides, it wouldn't be affordable.
Cedric, you explained that well. I now understand that autonomy has its limited value, but that it's not enough. And you explained nicely that this applies to my house, but that it actually also applies to entire countries. And that naturally gives me a new perspective on the question of how we should behave in Switzerland or Germany or France and other countries. How should we behave towards other countries? Because they are suddenly becoming electricity partners, which is something different from suppliers.
Exactly.
And that's a different situation. In the past, they may have been suppliers. The French supply a lot of energy to Germany from their nuclear power plants, I've heard. But that changes the moment mutual dependence is created. You now have a partnership that you have to maintain. And suddenly the idea of being independent from others is no longer helpful in the discussion. We have to take this a step further. Have I understood that correctly?
You understood perfectly, Michael. Let me illustrate this again. What is extremely important when we build or design a network, for example, a neighborhood transformation, EE, a modernization, is that we need redundancy. This must be guaranteed so that we can keep the power supply secure in the neighborhood. We don't do this with redundant protection for house connections, which is why an isolated solution is actually the right choice here. With substations, you have to think about this too. It has to work that way. If one feed-in doesn't work, you have to be able to control it somewhere so that it continues to function. But that can also be done electronically. The same applies to the states, and I believe there are several players involved in the entire system who support each other. There are transmission grids, for example, in Switzerland, Swiss Grid, and in France it is RTE, which must ensure that electricity is transported across the countries smoothly and in a coordinated manner. There are regulations within the European Union that, for example, in the coming years, 70% of the capacity between countries must be reserved for neighbors. That's, for Switzerland, there's a trade-off. If we are not part of this system, we won't be able to benefit from it, unfortunately. That would have economic consequences for us.
Yes.
It also stipulates that countries must inform each other about electricity flows as early as possible so that neighbors can react and compensate for shortages with cheaper energy. For example, unfortunately, Switzerland is currently excluded from this. So the flow of information is also extremely important. These are the transmission grids. Primeo is directly connected to Swissgrid as a network operator. For us, this is the so-called network level one, and we are responsible for security of supply from network level two to network level seven. That is where your house is connected. That is our role, and we have to invest a great deal to ensure certain things with the aim of having enough power available in the grid. That's why we're switching from 13 kilovolts to 20 kilovolts, so that we have more power in the grid and therefore more options. For example, it must become bidirectional and digital. Then there are lots of smart meters that we're rolling out, which have to be smarter, not necessarily in real time, but better than they are today. Everything has to be more controllable and able to send signals. When will this be needed? For example, to be able to control PV for those who want it when we have too much electricity in the system. And the other thing is the last element. We also have to try to anticipate the grid topology of the future. We need to have a rough idea of where it's going. Where will production sites be located? Where might we need energy storage in the grid? That's another reason why we've built a digital twin.
I think the digital twin is really, really important. I've always wondered about that as an engineer, and also because I helped develop a digital twin at my employer over many, many years. It's extremely useful because you can use it to simulate things.
Exactly.
You can go into a digital twin and say, okay, this is how the network architecture should actually behave. And then you simulate what happens if a high voltage line fails somewhere, for example, due to a storm, or in the worst case, if it is sabotaged or hit. Then the mast tips over and the line is out of service for days. It takes time for the mast to be put back up. And I want to know, how does the system remain stable despite this? How do you prevent such an event from throwing the entire network out of balance to the point of a blackout? In the past, such scenarios were played out on the drawing board. Today, this can be done digitally, with a twin. And that's exactly what it's needed for, to calculate complex network scenarios down to the smallest details. But who actually operates such a digital twin, now on a large scale, across countries? Do you do that?
No, we don't do that nationally or across countries. That's the role of Swiss Grid, the transmission grid operator. In France, it's RTE. Our role begins at grid level 2 and extends to the neighborhoods. But that's exactly where the whole thing has changed, hasn't it? With the new prosumers, people like you who want to produce their own electricity and consume it themselves. That makes sense, generating electricity where it is consumed.
Yes.
But of course, they have changed the rules of the game to a certain extent.
Sure, that's true.
In the past, electricity was produced centrally, distributed via the transmission grid, and then transported to your home via the distribution grid. Today, you want to produce it yourself. If a farmer wants to do that, for example, the overhead lines often have to be reinforced to make it possible, right? Because feeding into the grid doesn't automatically mean supplying it. And that's exactly the problem we have, that this decentralized energy world increases complexity enormously. And that's exactly what you have to do now with what happens if, in other words, with scenarios. And all these parameters that are developing, such as how many electric cars will there be in a neighborhood, how many heat pumps will there be in a neighborhood, that's much more power than in the past. If you substitute gas or oil with electricity, then of course you have much more power demand in neighborhoods than we used to have.
Yes, demand in neighborhoods is increasing with electrification.
And you have to be able to simulate that. For example, if electricity storage is part of a solution, would it be better to use neighborhood storage instead of laying thicker cables? These are the scenarios we are considering. And to do that, you definitely need software solutions, and that's our role, and that's what we do.
Exactly. You definitely need sensors and a lot of software to monitor the changing power flows.
What you just described, your scenario. So if a line in a transmission grid suddenly fails at a pylon, then you actually have a problem in the topology of northwestern Switzerland, because we currently have no or only weak redundancy. And that is the line that Swiss Grid has planned. The new line is to run from the Flumental substation in the canton of Solothurn to Derville, in the canton of Basel Landschaft, Azog-Hochoryde, Itzfok, Tarsa, etc., as a 220 kilovolt extra high voltage line. This will give us genuine redundancy. At the 220 kilovolt level and strengthen the security of supply in the Basel area. Swiss Grid is replacing the existing 145 kilovolt line with the new 220 kilovolt system over a distance of around 33 kilometers. But we at Primeo Energy crossed the border back in 1906 and already laid a line to Alsace. In some regions, the upper Alsace, e.g. via Sierentz, may even be closer than Flumental. An interesting paradox, isn't it?
Yes, it might make sense to think more openly about regional grid topologies when planning, across borders and not just nationally.
We should think a little more openly. Of course, it doesn't make things any easier, because RTE, the French grid operator, is also involved. But we at Primeo Energy believe that it is necessary to think beyond national grid topologies. There are definitely sensible solutions that cross borders.
Yes, absolutely. And you'll laugh. This discussion about high voltage lines and cross-border thinking is even reflected in my small system, because my feedback is limited. I've been in talks with my utility company for years. And the first response was, yes, you need a controllable local network transformer. But then they were all out of stock. There weren't any available at the time, so a temporary large transformer was installed. A piece of equipment as big as half a gara. The problem seemed to be solved until I asked, yes, will I now get an increase in my feedback? Yes. And now we come to the point about the high voltage pylons. I actually have these pylons on my property. I live in the countryside, where electricity is still supplied via real wooden pylons. And now they want to reinforce this line relatively soon. They are currently informing everyone affected and collecting signatures from all farmers and landowners. And if everyone agrees, the cross-section of the line will be reinforced and individual pylons will be reinforced. So I asked, why not give me the money for a larger home storage unit? That would probably solve the problem because it would reduce the peak load. But the answer was, yes, we're thinking long term. And the method of choice, as was kindly explained to me, is clearly to reinforce the line. Let's just say that the dialogue was only halfway successful. And in a small way, this is a reflection of what would be necessary on a larger scale, talking about what is really the best way to solve the actual problem.
You've outlined it wonderfully. I think the whole system is currently undergoing a transformation. And this transformation is causing many players to rethink their approach in an industry that is strongly characterized by a high degree of planning reliability. That makes it doubly difficult. Fortunately, people think that way because we benefit from a very, very high level of supply reliability. This is also thanks to the engineers who have spent many years planning carefully. Yes, but now we need a coordinated rethink of the methodology, and that takes a little longer. And that may also make the system a little more vulnerable, not directly, but indirectly. We are trying to do this carefully, of course, but it is also a cultural challenge, as you just described. It's very likely that we'll have to approach the issue with a new mindset. And that's precisely the challenge. And then there's digitalization. That's new. And it's sure to bring new challenges. Cybersecurity, for example. The vulnerability of software solutions. These are issues that we didn't even have on our radar in the past. We have to rethink things, and we have to make sure we do it right, because this is a critical infrastructure, and we have to continue to exercise great care. That's why the whole discussion is relevant. How quickly can the system be converted? How much money needs to be invested? If you go faster, then yes, you need significantly more money. And you might also make significantly more mistakes in the process. And that's where we are. At Primeo Energy, we try to promote exactly that. We have a network manager who is extremely innovative, and he also exemplifies this way of thinking. Now it's a question of balance, donc security of supply versus innovation. The two are not mutually exclusive. But it's a question of speed, how quickly you make this change.
Yes, and you also said that speed has to do with costs. Many people look at their electricity bills and say, it's actually going up all the time. How is that? Will we eventually be able to make electricity a little cheaper again? Or is the realistic forecast more likely to be that electricity has actually always been too cheap? It should actually be more expensive if you take everything into account. What is the right perspective on the price of electricity? How should we think about it?
I think you have to differentiate. The market price for electricity is a commodity that has a clear market signal. You can buy electricity on the electricity exchange, the so-called EX, that's the electricity exchange in Leipzig. Nortes sets the tone for future prices to a certain extent. Many players buy there. These are then the forward contracts that are concluded. And there is a clear price signal there, which is also generally accepted. But consider, these price signals apply to standardized products and not for your personal consumption profile. Many people don't understand that. I buy a standard product on the EEX, basically off the shelf, but I can't use it directly as it is. Someone has to shape it, adapt it to my profile. And that costs money, of course.
Exactly. We can feel that.
So yes, there is a clear price signal and prices are going down. We have now returned to a normal level after the crisis with very high electricity prices, around 70 to 80 francs per megawatt hour. It will go down a little further, but not as low as in 2016, when prices were at 30 or 40 euros per megawatt hour. That was for so-called baseload energy. Today, we pay twice as much, or 50% more, depending on the comparison. That's one thing. It's getting cheaper. But if we invest in new production, if we invest in infrastructure, such as the power grid, then of course it will be more expensive at first during the transition period. And then the question arises, is this an investment or simply an increase in costs? If you explain that it is an investment in the future, for the next generation, or for a period of 10 to 15 years, then many people understand that. So no one believed that electricity would become cheaper immediately when Switzerland invested in hydropower in the 1940s. At first, it became more expensive. But today, we, our generation, are benefiting from what our fathers built back then. And they were courageous. I think that's exactly the point. It feels like a gap or like a necessary step, but at its core, it's an investment. And yes, it will be written off over time. That has to be accepted. I am convinced that this will create more autonomy. And if we do it right, it will also strengthen the resilience of our society. It makes the future easier to plan, at least as far as energy costs are concerned. If I produce something myself and then if I've written it off and consume it myself, then I have much better planning security. Incidentally, this is not only true for private households. It applies just as much to industry. I think we have to acknowledge that for many people, it's better to have a predictable variable based on their own investment rather than being completely exposed to market prices. That's why many people want to generate some of their own electricity. That's the idea, to disconnect from the market to a certain extent. And now the question arises, what is the right mix? Continue to purchase some from the market and produce some yourself. Perhaps a 70-30 solution is the answer, or 80-20, or 50-50. Ultimately, it's a question of risk tolerance for private individuals. Can I afford this investment? Yes or no? Perhaps the energy supplier will take this on. For example, in a contracting model, we do this at Premio Energy. Today, you are free to choose. And I think that's a healthy approach.
So you would actually have to say it's good that the price is higher now, because that helps the overall system to make the necessary investments that we need so that we and the next generation have a secure, sustainable energy system based on the sustainable principles that we recognize today.
Yes, exactly. And the whole debate that I have had many times is, what does this mean in the short term for the competitiveness of trade and industry? Or what are the social components of this higher electricity price? Because electricity is a common good, it has a social component, but also an economic one. This must be carefully considered. We need an industry that continues to produce here so that jobs remain secure. Access to energy is crucial. Not only that it's available, but also that it remains affordable.
Yes, and if you want to negotiate with other countries, you have to be strong. Otherwise, no one will listen.
Exactly. And that leads me to a point where I am convinced if we remain connected to the European Union, the system will be more favorable for us. Electricity will then also tend to be cheaper. An example. In July 2022, Swiss Grid introduced three new sets of regulations to remain compatible with Europe.
I'm not familiar with those.
They are called Marie, Terre, and Picasso. This has had an impact on balancing energy. That is, the less energy you buy when you have made a wrong forecast, that happens. Now, you can't predict electricity consumption perfectly. The additional costs from July 1st, 2022, to April 2025 amount to 194 million Swiss francs. The consumer pays for this. Why? Because we imported the regulations, but are not yet benefiting from the European Union. That is the huge bathtub that we unfortunately cannot use at the moment. And today, we have the disadvantages and not the advantages. That is why I am arguing that we should say yes to the electricity agreement now. It means greater security of supply, better grid stability, better investment security, but also cost efficiency. And that is crucial. Or even your neighbor, your neighborhood, your country, the other country. It is very important for us that we remain truly competitive in the future. If we get it wrong, it will be unnecessarily expensive. And in my opinion, there is a contradiction between autonomy and self-sufficiency. This is misunderstood, I repeat myself, but it is essential that we separate these two concepts.
Can you briefly describe again what self-sufficiency and autonomy are? Because the terms are very close in people's minds.
So self-sufficiency would be if you are no longer connected to the general power grid. You, Mikkel, would then have an isolated solution, not just for a few hours, but for the whole year or for several years. That means you have to produce your own electricity for those 8,760 hours throughout the year. You want to be able to use it when you want it.
Exactly.
You don't just want electricity when the sun is shining. By the way, the sun shines for about 1,000 hours in those 8,760 hours of a year.
It's not as much as you think.
No, it's not that much. And what can you do with wind? We only get about 2,000 hours a year. That means you have to produce much, much more than you need to have electricity available when you want it. Or you have to work with a lot of energy storage and so on. That costs money too, doesn't it? That's complete self-sufficiency. But if you want autonomy, then you want life insurance. That's what an electricity grid operator offers you. Electricity all year round. That's so logical. It's like health insurance. You can only do that on a large scale. Otherwise, it becomes too expensive. That's true even with the electricity. And if you say you need a power line, then you're autonomous. You can increase your degree of self-sufficiency with your own photovoltaics and produce your own electricity. That's also good, I would say. We support that at Primeo, even though it makes our power grid a little more expensive because it means it's used a little less. You could say that the unit costs per kilowatt hour are rising, right? Yes, but that doesn't matter, we say. Because if we use more electricity, especially renewable electricity, then the electrification of transport and heat generation will replace fossil fuels such as oil and gas. And that will very likely also contribute to significantly higher consumption in our grids in Switzerland, but also in Europe, even if people produce their own energy and thus make a contribution. That is good autonomy. And that's why we say yes to autonomy. It's a good idea for you at home. This also applies to Switzerland. It is the federal government's energy strategy. Once again, 70% is to be produced in Switzerland. That's a lot, but it's not complete self-sufficiency. Complete self-sufficiency is not affordable, not even for Switzerland. It would be far too expensive.
And yet everything is based on a value system. So it depends on how you think. So I can imagine that there are different opinions among energy suppliers. That's logical, and that it may take some time for everyone to come to the same conclusion. Because what you're talking about means more cooperation and more networking and more partnership, i.e. mutual dependence. But that's different from saying, yes, we're now going to build lots of power plants only in Switzerland and for ourselves. That would be a completely different way of thinking. It has something to do with the value system.
That's right. Maybe we have an advantage because we are a cooperative. We simply think differently culturally. We have different DNA. Since, I believe, the birth of the company, we have tried to be on an equal footing with our partners and to negotiate. But because we have crossed the border, as I said, we are not afraid. 1906 was before the First and Second World Wars. And don't forget that the 11 or 12 municipalities in Alsace were only connected to the French grid in 2012. So between 1906 and 2012, it was an electricity island, a Swiss electricity island in France.
Unbelievable.
Okay, and we have a lot in common with these Alsatian communities because the power supply was guaranteed, even between 1939 and 1945, and between 1914 and 1918. So that shows what Primeau wanted and was capable of. Primeau was very small back then, and our cooperative's risk-bearing capacity is still very small. But the founding fathers wanted cooperation, and we are still benefiting from that today. And we believe it is necessary to think this way because it makes us stronger. And now, we also have a lot of wind and solar power plants abroad. Why is that? It's simple. Because the technology costs the same whether you use it in Switzerland or in southern France or southern Italy. But the sun, the primary energy source, shines twice as much or 50% more on these panels. This means that our production costs in southern Italy, southern Spain, or southern France are significantly lower than in Switzerland. And why shouldn't Swiss consumers be able to benefit from this? That was the idea. And that's why we said we would build these power plants abroad. Wind power is very regular on the coast of France and Spain, and there is a lot of wind. We have many more hours of wind, which is why we decided to invest where the primary energy is available. That's also why we went to Norway. Norway is Europe's water tower. It has a lot of hydropower, and that was our own idea. And yes, the electricity we produce in Spain does not physically reach Switzerland, but it does financially. And what we are saying is we still need to find systems, for example, for cross-border exchange via the Swiss border to import electricity in an environmentally friendly way. We want to try that in the future to make the connection between the European Union and Switzerland a model for others. Incidentally, we have been importing nuclear power between France and Switzerland for years. So that's not questioned. If it works with nuclear power, it can also be done with wind energy.
Yes, you've just answered two or three questions I had in mind. But first, let's get back to the cooperative. I think you really do have several advantages. Firstly, you are long-standing and experienced. You went abroad early on and gained valuable experience, including in cross-border cooperation. This has enabled you to build up a strong network and genuine partnerships, and you have a culture that emphasizes cooperation. This allows you to approach many issues more openly, including sensitive issues such as security of supply and pricing. Because, as I said earlier, there are different opinions on how to shape the energy transition. And now you've already touched on something I wanted to ask you anyway. How long will this energy transformation actually take?
Look, Michael, I was asked this question recently in another podcast. Someone wanted to know whether we should admit that it will take until 2080 instead of 2050. My answer was, that would be like an athlete saying he won't achieve his goal anyway, so why bother trying? If we say we won't make it by 2050, it will demotivate people. An athlete doesn't do that. Neither does a company. We humans need stages, milestones, and that's why I say quite clearly, yes, we can do it by 2050. And everything we do now should take us there, but without unnecessary risks. We're not spending money just to be fast. We use our resources wisely and strive to maintain a good balance. Just to remind you, our cooperative capital is zero.
How does that work?
We invest everything we earn. That's why we have to be particularly careful with our finances. Capital is a scarce commodity, and for us it is a very scarce commodity. We therefore try to remain free cash flow positive. In other words, to invest only as much as we earn. And that makes it challenging, of course. The big question is, will we be able to invest everything that is necessary to achieve our goals by 2050? Whether we achieve this in 2045 or 2055 is ultimately secondary. The important thing is that we stick to our goal and don't take away people's hope. After all, infrastructure takes time, change requires acceptance, and we can only achieve that through dialogue, not by persuasion. And that is our role as a cooperative. We belong to our customers, and we are committed to them.
I think it's very important that we don't delude ourselves into thinking that this will be done in 5 years.
No, definitely not.
There are people who say, we have to change everything right now. Electric cars for everyone, everything immediately. But that's not how it works. It has to be done step by step. And you said it yourself, the limitation lies in the capital. If we had unlimited capital, we could perhaps move faster. But then the risk of making mistakes would also be higher. That's why I think your approach is good, step by step, with a clear view of the results. And you also have the digital twin that allows you to monitor this. I think that's a very balanced strategy.
One example, fortunately, we didn't invest in batteries too early. prices have fallen sharply, and we are now benefiting from that. Incidentally, it was the same with photovoltaics.
That's right.
Are you familiar with the Swanson curve?
No, please explain it to us.
For those who don't know, the Swanson curve is a kind of learning curve for solar technology. It says that every time production doubles, manufacturing costs are halved. It's similar to Moore's law for microchips, only for photovoltaics. And it's been pretty accurate. We believe it will be the same for batteries. That's why a staggered investment makes sense. You benefit from falling costs and technical advances.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
Technology is evolving, and that's why it's sometimes smarter not to do everything at once.
Good point. So slower can be smarter than fast.
Exactly. It's about balance and common sense. Determination, yes, but without ideology. And with a healthy sense of proportion.
You could say it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Exactly. It's going to be a marathon.
And because it's going to be a marathon, the younger generation has a big role to play. The projects I'm familiar with are about getting young people on board, raising their awareness, and giving them the tools they need. And when I arrived at your site, I saw a sign that said museum. What is that?
We see ourselves as part of society, and we invest specifically in the next generation. We have created an interactive energy world. Around 5,000 children and young people visit every year. They build small solar cars out of wood with solar panels and electric motors, and it works.
Brilliant. That's perfect for the youth work I'm involved in. Building a solar car, it's perfect.
Exactly. It's about teaching science in a playful way. The whole thing is part of our science center called Cosmos. It's a great building, by the way. 70% of the construction materials were reused. The supporting structure is made of old electricity pylons, and the wood comes from old floor coverings. Sustainability in practice. And it's all about very simple questions. What is a kilowatt? What is a kilowatt hour? How much energy does it take to blow dry your hair, even if you don't have any left? And how many watts can I generate with my bike? We've all become superhumans with this incredible amount of energy at our disposal, but we hardly feel it anymore. And that's exactly where we want to raise awareness. What is the energy transition? What is wind power? What is it? What is solar energy? What is still missing? A visit takes 30 minutes and you leave with a better understanding. And there is also a practical aspect. We want to attract talent. The transformation requires new skills, digital literacy, math, and data processing. All of these are becoming increasingly important. And there's a bit of self-interest in that too. We work with universities, with ETH and others. We want to attract bright minds who can help us make the power system smarter. For example, through digital twins, including in heat generation.
Then let's do it. We'll put a link to the Science Center in the show notes.
Sure.
And maybe we'll manage to get a few more young people to visit.
Wonderful. That would be great. We have around 20,000 visitors a year. And if there are more, all the better.
Exactly. Ultimately, it's all about trust. Trust in our partners, in the technology, in the power grid. Without this trust, everything becomes more expensive. A hospital needs a stable energy supply. The same goes for refrigerated transport. If I can't count on the shared grid, I have to double everything up, and that costs money. Trust is the prerequisite for an affordable future.
Michael, I like to use pension funds as an example. The first pillar, that's the AHV, corresponds to the public power grid. The second pillar is the electricity you produce yourself. And the third pillar is your emergency power generator, your diesel generator.
South, the first pillar is the state pension, the power grid. The second pillar is the electricity you generate yourself. And the third pillar is the generator for emergencies.
And this analogy may help to understand what the energy supply of the future will look like. It's really impressive what we are doing now in the next 20 years. We're rebuilding a system to make it more resilient, cheaper, and CO2-free. Let's do it. I am convinced that we can do it. Together with the next generation.
Cedric, thank you for your clear explanations. That's exactly what this podcast is about. Making innovation tangible, strengthening trust, and giving hope. I think we've come a long way today. The most important takeaway: true security of supply comes from cooperation, not isolation. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate it.
That was episode 16 of Michael's Green World, the podcast about the green transition, ecological, economic, and with technical realism, with a pinch of hope that we will succeed. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it with others, subscribe to the channel or the show, and stay tuned as we continue to explore how we can make the transition work together. Until next time.